Welcome to Geared for Growth. I'm your host, Mike Mortlock from MCG Quantity Surveyors. Today we're talking everything finance and lending. We've got mortgage broker par excellence, Richard Morgan from Freedom Funding. Now we talked to him about what's changed in lending in the last little while and what's on the horizon as well in terms of interest rate cuts, in terms of APRA changes to their serviceability buffers, and we focus in on ways that you can supercharge your portfolio and especially taking advantage of the market conditions we're likely to see in the next couple of years. It's a really, really insightful interview with a very intelligent man in the broking space. I'm sure you'll get something out of this. Here's Richard. Thanks for joining me on Geared for Growth.
Pleasure to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. And, you know, you say pleasure, but I'm going to hit you with some big topics because there's a lot going on in and around property in the lead up to the election. I think, you know, we're talking about the federal election in 2025, which is still, you know, a year away, but it does kind of seem like the battle lines are sort of being drawn. We don't know exactly what it's going to be about, but cost of living and property is you know, property's a perennial one, but property's definitely going to be in the mix for the upcoming election. So I want to chat to you about, you know, how we prepare ourselves as people in the property industry, as property investors, for, you know, some of these nasty debates about capital gains tax and negative gearing. But catch us up to speed first, if you will, about what's happening in lending at the moment. Has there been much changing in that environment?
Yeah, it's certainly a dynamic environment at the moment, Mike. There's been a lot that has happened, and a lot of this stuff has been making it a little bit easier for people to borrow money. The problem is right now, the crux of it is that most investors and most borrowers can't quite get enough in terms of borrowing capacity. And the reason for that is all of those RBA rate increases have really hampered borrowing capacity. You can sort of see at the moment, you know, if you look at an individual borrowing capacity calculator, it's some 40% down on where it was you know, prior to those rate increases. We're looking at debt to income ratios. I remember that being a problem. You get some borrowers at 7 or 8% DTI where banks would tap out. And these days, really depending on the type of investor and what income streams they've got, you could be anywhere between sort of 3 to 5 times debt to income ratio. So that's a substantial drop.
That is a drop. Now, is the answer to that really just the increase in interest rates? Because we went from, you know, environment where it was, you know, 2 or thereabouts to now, what are we talking, 5, 6s maybe?
Yeah, it's into the sixes now. It's not necessarily just the interest rate increases on their own. But also we've had that inflationary piece hit household living expenses. So that's pushed up substantially over the cost of the last couple of years, and rightly so, given the price of groceries and fuel and all those sort of staple products. And then I guess lastly is the, I think it was 2021, October 2021, APRA changed the guidance around the buffer required for prudential lending. And so the buffer that was being applied to you know, existing and new lending was 2.5%. Yep. That went from 2.5% to 3%, which you know, took a little bit of wind out of the sails from a borrowing capacity perspective as well.
Which, you know, people like us don't really appreciate, but, you know, they do have a responsibility to make sure that we're not putting ourselves into a position like we can get into a mortgage crisis like in the US. But it begs the question. The serviceability buffer at, you know, 3%, the pundits are pricing in interest rates to be steady maybe for the next little bit and drops. And certainly I would say all economists are saying, you know, by 2025 or at least in 2025, there's going to be quite a slew of drops. So does APRA look at that and adjust those buffers, or will that likely to be sticking around as a bit of a sticky buffer for a while, do you think?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think if you think through that logically and go, okay, well, if an investor's paying 6.5% on a investment loan at the moment, then in order to borrow that, they need to show that they can service that debt at 9.5%. I don't know about you, Mike, but I don't reckon we're going to see 9.5% interest rates anytime soon. I certainly hope not, because
I think there'd be blood in the streets if that
100%,
was
100%. It's a very far-fetched scenario. So I'm sure that the regulator APRA is looking at that going, okay, well, that probably doesn't make a lot of sense logically. However, they need to look at things independently. Obviously, prudential and risk and all that sort of stuff is very important, and it is the reason that our banking sector is so strong. If you look at the strength of our banking sector versus you know, some of the stuff that's happening internationally, we're in a great position, and you know, part of that is those tight controls. So certainly that's the right thing to do. I think at the moment, if you look at adjusting those buffers or bringing those buffers back down in line of, you know, the 2.5% where it was, then that will probably be an inflationary thing. So that will increase borrowing capacity, and as a result, you know, you're going to let inflation out of the bag a little bit more. So I think once we get to that cycle where the rates start to come down, at some point then it will make sense for APRA to revisit those buffers.
Do you think APRA cares about inflation? Because, of course, if they were to reduce the buffer today, to me, there's no risk, there's no extra risk in default, but, of course, there is upside risk to inflation. But does that sort of fall under their purview? Are they sort of working in concert with the RBA or the finance minister? Like, is that their consideration?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in theory, they're supposed to be purely independent and, you know, focused on the metrics and the data that they're focused on. But I suppose in terms of the wider economic piece, you know, you want these pieces to work together. There's no point in introducing a policy on the left hand, which is going to be inflationary, and then on the right hand, you know, trying to curb inflation. So I think working in together in terms of APRA and the RBA, that makes a lot of sense to manage it that way.
Yeah, I suppose there's quite a lot of examples where that hasn't been the case. And I mean, the mess that we're in at the moment from an inflation point of view really comes down, in my view, to the mass stimulus package that we got during COVID. Now, I've sort of said to people, gosh, it's very easy to criticize in hindsight, but from a country that couldn't run an online referendum or a census, we were very good at getting money into the pockets of people that, you know, arguably not everyone that needed it got it. Some that didn't get it needed it. Do you think that's what really the big picture is, that we're unwinding that stimulus now, and that's the pain of the stickiness of inflation?
Yeah, 100%. I think that that was an unparalleled amount of money that was printed during COVID, and not just in Australia, I mean internationally, right? So off the back of that, I don't think anyone sort of anticipated just how big an effect that would have and how wild a response that was to the pandemic. But, you know, it's funny looking back at it now, and you kind of go, oh, geez, how did that all happen? How did we end up in the position that we're in now? And, you know, you've got to put yourself back in that scenario of going, okay, well, no one knows what's happening. This could be end of the world stuff in terms of plague and whatever else. So, you know, the governments around the world made the best decision they could at the time with the information they had. And, you know, as a result, we are where we are. So, yeah, we're dealing with that hangover now in terms of the inflation. I think it's going to be stickier and harder to navigate than a lot of people sort of think it is. We went into it's the last year talking about rates decreasing by the end of 2023. That's obviously not happened. Now we're talking about, is it going to be mid-2024 or late 2024? Maybe it will. Certainly the US are very bullish around forecasting the rates to drop. But I wouldn't be surprised if we don't start to see that happen until next year in 2025.
Oh, Richard.
But don't worry, it's not my decision, Mike. So
I know, in a way, I'm glad it's not your decision. Well, I mean, I suppose you would decide to do it sooner, right? But it's just your expectation.
Let's
of
do
what's
it.
Gonna
yeah,
happen. Yeah, 100%. Let's do it. Let's cut it to 1.5 basis points.
Yeah, no worries, and off we go. Yeah.
You'll be a very, very busy man if that's the case. So we talked about, you know, potentially unwinding the buffer to some degree, but is there anything that we know that is on the horizon for lending?
Yeah, so obviously the buffer would be a big one, but I would say that would come in after a couple of other pieces. So the rates decreasing is certainly going to be something that will happen at a point in time, and that will boost borrowing capacity. It really depends on the position that you're in as to how much benefit that will provide you, but probably somewhere between sort of 5 to 8%. Generally speaking, you'll find an improvement in borrowing capacity if we have two or three rate cuts in the mix. And then the other thing that is definitely happening is the stage three tax cuts. So I know they've been around the world with Albo and what he was going to do and what he has done. At the end of the day, it will be a better position for most borrowers. Should improve borrowing capacity by about 5%, and that will definitely come in on the 1st of July, provided that they don't change their mind again, of course.
Now it begs the question, we're in a pretty strong market as it is at the moment. Now it's of course it's not a broad story across the country. We're seeing places like Perth and Brisbane and Sydney to a reasonable extent and Adelaide doing very, very well, places like Melbourne, Canberra, Hobart, Darwin really, really struggling. Do those little tweaks, the let's say APRA comes after a couple of cuts, whenever that happens, I mean, you say 2025 potentially, I'm hoping back end of this year. Do you expect that to put some real fire under the backside of the property market, given that people's capacities will increase by, maybe that 8 to 10% and we've probably got some people that now are able to get into the market that perhaps weren't before? What do you see playing out?
The Geared for Growth Property Investing podcast is presented by our business, MCG Quantity Surveyors. If you're an investor or a property professional looking to get the best tax depreciation deductions for yourself or your clients, please get in touch with us at mcgqs.com.au. It's our mission to help as many property investors as we can to maximise their claims and maximise their property education as well.
Yeah, I think there's definitely potential here for there to be. I'm reluctant to call it a boom, but if you look backwards, we've had growth in the market. Over the course of 2023, almost double digit growth nationally, despite the fact that borrowing capacity has dropped by almost 40%. So that to me is almost an anomaly around market behavior and the fact that the market isn't growing in line with sort of the credit growth or contraction. I do think if we have an increase in borrowing capacity to the tune of, we're talking about 17, 18%, if those three things come off, if we do have those three things come off, then I do think that is the market is going to respond. People are looking to borrow more. People have an appetite to invest. People have an appetite to, upgrade their owner-occupied homes and, whatever that scenario is, people want to borrow more. And the banks have an appetite to lend more. Over the course of the last 12 months in particular, there's been a lot of really good policy changes that have enhanced borrowing capacity, whether that's taking a higher amount of rental income and shading less rental income, whether that's using the latest year bonus in isolation. There's a lot of really small tweaks that have come in that I think have, to a degree, offset some of those rate increases and those things that have hampered borrowing capacity. So the banks have set the scene in terms of policy for things to take off. We just need a few of those pieces to fall into place. So stage three tax cuts, rate drops. And then the buffer dropping potentially to 2.5% or less, and yeah, absolutely, the market should take off. And once it takes off, as you know, having been through some property cycles yourself, Mike, and those of us old enough to appreciate it, when it takes off quickly. The media gets behind it, and markets very much become, back to that FOMO that we saw a couple of years ago.
I've been saying to anyone that will listen, the best time to buy was yesterday, but given yesterday's unavailable, go today. Don't wait for the green shoots, because I think once the media has got wind of it, you're kind of 2 or 3 months behind what's actually happened from a transactions point of view.
I agree. If you're on the ground and you're seeing things shift, that's that's essentially, it's almost too late at that stage. You really want to get into that market before you see things shift. Because once you build up that momentum in the market and you've got multiple bidders buying properties and all competing for the same set of turf, then prices really start to go upward from there. So I do think that gives investors and those people looking for an opportunity, there is a window ahead before things do change and before that sentiment does ramp up. So certainly a good position for people to be in if you've got the borrowing capacity and the capital to make it work now.
Mm, yeah, good advice, I think. Now, talking about shifting, we have the Albanese government that have said that they're not going to change their policy on capital gains tax and negative gearing, yet someone sent me a message saying, did you know that Albo said 31 times that there wouldn't be any changes to the stage three tax cuts, yet there were. So things like that make me a little bit nervous, especially with, you know, the power that the Greens have at the federal level at the moment. And it's nothing against the Greens, but their housing policies, I think, are to the detriment of the nation for a number of different reasons. That's another show. But what do you expect to be the battleground in and around property and housing affordability and those sorts of policies in the lead up to the federal election next year?
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. And I do remember the last time Labor were trying to have a go at franking credits and negative gearing and all that sort of stuff started to hit the table, and they were shooing what was it, 2017, 2018, 2019, I can't remember the year, but they were shooing to win the election, but they just kept adding one more thing and then one more thing, and then eventually I think that sort of that arrogance of pushing it too far lost them the election. Be interesting to see how this one progresses, because at the moment, you're right, he's saying the right things in terms of not putting negative gearing on the table or putting franking credits on the table to chop. But I think the reality between now and the election in 2025, because it's September 2025 or before, the reality is going to be that things are going to get tougher between now and then. And I think this debt, this hangover in terms of printing money and inflation, someone's going to have to pay the bill for that. And I think the easiest way for governments to go after that is they'll look for a cash cow. And unfortunately, within property, you've got property investors, who are, I guess, a silent majority, maybe silent minority. I don't know where the numbers stand, but certainly seems like an easy target for the government to go after. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see tax reform centered around property investing, centered around things like CGT, land tax, and so forth, that it has the potential to make it a little bit more difficult for investors, but I think it'll be part of sweeping tax reform across the board, which is probably going to need to happen in order to pay that debt back.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, from a politics point of view, I think we realise that there's been some state intervention that has exacerbated affordability, certainly rental affordability, where we saw with our own data during the Queensland land tax changes, there were 98 days that we analysed where people could purchase in full knowledge of the decision that the taxes were going to go up in 1 July. And we saw a 14% drop in investment in Queensland, which is a big number. And that's not the whole story. That's the investors coming in. And there's also the investors that were selling that PropTrack shared some data on. So what do you think are some of the unintended consequences of going to an election with a policy? Like, maybe they will leave negative gearing, they will leave capital gains tax, but perhaps there will be some sort of federal land tax or housing levy. I mean, we saw the Medicare levy hitting our hip pockets some time ago for high income earners. Do you see something like that happening, and can something like that come in and target exactly what it's trying to do, or do you see that there's always unintended consequences with some intervention like that?
Yeah, look, I think the reality is that they can put together whatever they want to put together and call it whatever they want. The main issue I have personally with the government intervention is not so much the principle of taking the money from high income owners or property investors or whatever it is, but the way that money is spent is so inefficient that if you're running a business, if this was private enterprise instead of the government, there'd be no way that they'd be allowed to spend the money the way that they spend it. So, I guess at a fundamental level, that's the issue I would take with the way that tax money is appropriated. I think it's definitely a threat. And if you look at, I guess, the state by state comparison of how some of that stuff that you mentioned played out, with Queensland, obviously they've reversed their decision around that. I think that was a good outcome. And I think logic prevailed at the end of the day. If you have a look at what's happening in Victoria at the moment, I think out of all of the COVID, state-based performance, I think, unfortunately, Victoria being, the most locked down city in the world, had the sort of biggest impact economically. And you can see some of the reform state-based around property down there hasn't been great for investors. And, you could hypothesize that as a result of that, you're looking at the median house price of Melbourne coming in line with Brisbane. Well, that's quite ridiculous when you think about the trajectory of population and growth in Melbourne is supposed to supply Sydney in the not too distant future. So there's a disconnect there. I think that, if you're going after property and going after property investors, there needs to be a right time and a right place from a macro environment perspective. And when we've got a housing crisis in terms of we don't have enough dwellings nationally or state-based, for that matter, to support the population that we've got and the immigration that's coming in, now is certainly not the best time to go after that group, because property investors, are needed in terms of providing that housing supply for people that are renting and coming into the country.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing evidence of what happens when property investors are disincentivized and, rents are gone through the roof after a 16-year period where they didn't outperform inflation in broad terms. So I think we've definitely got that double-blind trial sort of evidence that's come in. Now, Richard, it'd be remiss of me as a mortgage broker par excellence not to pick your brain about what property investors should know about the finance world in an economy where potentially we have some interest rate cuts, we have some potential APRA changes, we've got an election in the mix. For people that are looking to expand their portfolio or get their sort of first or second property, is there any sort of fundamental advice that you could say, look, this is where you need to put your focus?
Yeah, I think right now is, like I mentioned earlier, I think it's a unique window of opportunity for somebody that's looking to scale up or increase their portfolio. I think at the moment there are some good niche policies available around, being able to restructure your debt and refinance with a lower buffer than that 3% buffer, which you could take advantage of. If you can restructure your debt in preparation for, the rates coming down and get yourself ready for that next purchase, then that's one side of it. What a lot of more sophisticated investors are doing is they're looking at some more advanced finance strategies in order to get themselves exposure to the market now, rather than waiting for things to change. And so the way that they can approach that is, restructuring their existing lending to make it more attractive for a non-bank in order to purchase one or two more properties. Because with the non-banks, they'll take, servicing based on actual repayments for existing and a buffer as low as 1% for the new purchase. So that explodes your serviceability out. Now, the issue with using banks like that is they're expensive from an interest rate perspective. Yep. But if you're able to, get that exposure now whilst you've got that market, which isn't competitive, and then, in 18 months time, once we've seen that next sort of cycle in terms of rates dropping, you know, buffers being tweaked, and, you know, stationary tax cuts and so forth, and borrowing capacity increasing, then you can move from that non-bank into a normal bank and refinance that down the track. But you've taken advantage of being able to get exposure to the market before we've had a sort of credit-based boom, which is certainly something that might be on the horizon with those indicators.
Yep. Now, if interest rates are, let's say, what would you say, 6.5% on average at the moment, or 6%, where help me out here.
Pardon me, anywhere between sort of 6, 6.5, yep, depending on the owner arc or investment, interest only, and so on.
Yeah, there's always caveats there. So let's say interest rates, we could get a loan for an investment property at 6%, or we could get an interest a loan on two investment properties at X percent with a non-bank. What sort of interest rate premium are we paying on top of, say, the big four?
Yeah, there's always caveats around the specifics, but you know, generally speaking, you'd pay another percentage point on top of what you would pay to use the majors. So it's not a substantial amount, and not talking a substantial amount more fees either.
Yes, but given the opportunities present in the next little while, I mean, this isn't financial advice, and do your own research and that sort of thing. We don't have a proper disclaimer, but we'll call that one. For someone that is still in that accumulation phase, they feel secure in their employment, you know, there's no guarantees in the property market, anything could happen. But if we're moving into, let's say, a period where we could see 15 to 20% growth in the next 2 years, would the perfect strategy be to extend yourself as much as you're comfortable, but then look at that equity growth during that period to then refinance to one of the major banks?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I think that the strategy, because it's more advanced, you really need to sit with your broker and work through, you know, how is this going to play out? What's the sequence of events? You know, what do you need to do with your existing stuff? And how does that exit plan come together? So, you know, is it going to be a combination of an increase in income over that time plus, you know, the rates dropping and serviceability improving? Or, you know, is that going to be an opportunity to sort of look at your existing portfolio, maybe refine, maybe sell down one that you've had that's underperforming? Really look at it holistically and then work out what that plan is for you individually, because it does have risks associated with it. In which, you know, you're going into this structure and this commitment, and you're not able to refinance out in the future. So you need to make sure that you do that due diligence and you work through that piece and what it works for you. But essentially, it's an opportunity, knowing that there's potential growth on the horizon. You take a little bit more of a risk. You pay a little bit more in terms of your interest rate. But if you can get 10 or 20% upside in terms of asset value, then you know, you would take that risk every other day.
Could be a time to swing for the fence, but yours is sensible advice. Mine is not advice in any way, shape or form. Don't take it, but I wish anyone luck that is looking to expand their portfolio in the next little while. There's certainly things pointing to some opportunity. Richard, thank you very much for sharing your time and your wisdom today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. Appreciate it.
Cheers.